Okay. Well, I will repeat the last, or the announcement that I made, that there is a town hall after this. I think they're really primarily undergraduate related, but the key point is that there will be multiple pizzas which will be delivered. And my understanding is they are starting at something like 5:30, which is close to our let-out time. So if you head over there, you'd probably do fairly well at getting some pizza. It'll be in Lennon 313. Well, they usually never have the pizza exactly when events start. You know, it usually shows up a little late. My guess is 5:40, 5:45, exactly when this course is over. Might be good timing. Today. Yes, right after class today. Ah, I knew graduate students would be interested. Where's Andy? Oh, okay. I was going to say. Okay. Well, let's see how well we're going to get through all of this stuff today. Don't worry, we had already gotten through all of this. This was the simple stuff. And the expected value of the function, basically of a continuous or discrete random variable. And by the way, I will point out, in a lot of real problems, if you don't know the probability density function or the probabilities, we end up assuming them. Especially for the discrete case, if we have like maybe 100 events, we're going to assume then the probability of each one is 1/100. We would assume that they would be equally likely. Now that's not always true. He's not over there waiting for the pizza. I was pointing out to them that I guess they're going to have pizza at the town hall meeting right after this class. It's today, and I think, you know, they're going to start at 5:30, but pizza never shows up on time. So my guess is 5:40 or 5:45. It's a random variable. Okay. Anyway, just reminding you of the notation from the last time, for those of you who haven't done a lot of statistics, the expected value, x bar, the mean, all of these definitions assume that you know either the probability density function or probability. In many cases, you can assume it. In fact, the usual one is the assumed Gaussian. Or, in the discrete case, we'll often assume that they're equally probable. 100 events, 1/100 is your probability. Anyway, I want to get up here. Oh, variance, remember that from last time? That's going to play an important role in today's lecture. These are for single variables. Okay? Variance, and actually I'm going to relate it to the correlation coefficient in just a little bit. Okay. The standard deviation is the square root of the variance, and we are subtracting off the mean. So this is a central moment. Okay? Oh, okay, got ahead of myself. We can have these to higher order powers. We don't usually use the higher order powers. We tend to restrict ourselves primarily to the second. And occasionally, you might see a third or a fourth. But I'm not planning on using anything other than n equals 2. We don't, okay. Gaussian distributions are what we're going to assume for most things. I'll show you some multidimensional stuff in a little bit. The mean is the m, the expected value, the variable I was talking about earlier. And we have our variance, sigma squared, and of course the square root of sigma, and that helps with the width of the distribution. Okay. Yes. It's square root of 2 pi. Because you notice it's... Some of these I typed myself. This one was typed actually, though, by Gonzalez. I think he actually did these himself. Okay. Now, here's sort of where I wanted to get a little started, because everything that we're going to do is involving matrices. Okay? these can be multiple variables. They will be multiple variables. I'm going to show you an example in a little bit where we're going to be tracking a moving vehicle and what X1, X2, and we'll do X3 and X4 will be. First one will be the X position of a corner of a truck. The second one will be the Y position of the corner of a truck. The third one will be the velocity in the X direction that that corner of the truck is moving. And the fourth one will be the Y velocity. And basically what we'll be starting to do is starting to talk about these, and I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. We'll start talking about states of a system. Okay, but when I use bold, it means that it's a vector. And we can have, in general, a multivariate probability density function. We can also have a multivariate cumulative distribution function. Okay? Nothing changes other than they've got a lot of variables in them. Okay? Now, needless to say, the expected value expression can get a lot bigger now for these multiple variables. The function has a lot of variables. We've got the probability. But the basic definitions stay the same. Now, this is real important in computing all of this stuff. The expected value of two of the different variables in that vector. This might be the relationship between x and y, coordinates of that point. Or it could be something completely different. Later on in chapter 10, we'll see an example. What's the correlation between the type of flower and the length of the petal and things like that? It could be completely different things depending upon your application. It might be a MEMS application. It could be an industrial inspection. Just like we were doing earlier when we were talking about central moments, you know, X minus M or whatever power, you can have each of these individual random variables to a power. The power, in this case, can actually get quite high. And I'm going to show you that we'll be doing these in matrices. The really nice thing is, given a set of data, usually there are computer programs that will compute all the statistics for you. That's nice. Okay. Now, two random variables, just x and y. That's all that we've done here. We haven't done anything interesting with the probability density function yet, and it's just called the joint moment. Usually, I won't even use the term joint moment. What I'm going to instead use is the notation correlation, denoted by an R. And actually, if you look up other textbooks, this is often called the cross-correlation and the autocorrelation. If x and y are different variables, then that's called usually the cross-correlation. If this is the same variable, you can have an x and an x. Okay? You can have a variable correlated with itself. Okay, and I'm going to talk about what that means. Okay. But you can have an RxX there. That would make it an autocorrelation. Let me get to that. I personally like to think of, and it, you're getting about 8 slides ahead, of it as the dot product between two random vectors. But you're on the right track. Okay. If we can separate the probability density function, then we can actually separate the integrals and we'll have the product of the expected values, the mean of x and the mean of y. And this is great. This occurs when these variables are statistically independent. The simple practical definition, as far as you're concerned right now, is they have no relationship to each other at all. Okay? Good and simple. If we asked any of our stat professors, they would give us a much better definition of that. Okay. Now, we're just taking two particular moments, 2, 0, 0, 2. You notice that it's x minus the mean of x squared, y minus the mean of y squared. This is when we're into our variances. Okay? So variances, we're subtracting that central mean. This is the important one, a real important one. This is actually the covariance. We've subtracted the means off. It's the same as our correlation earlier, cross-correlation and autocorrelation, which was x and y, but we didn't subtract them off. By doing this, we get the covariance. And again, I'll stress, it's a really important point. Don't worry, I'm not building up for it or anything. I'm just thinking maybe I can eliminate the microphone noise a little bit by getting rid of all this garbage in my pocket. Because it was way down in my pocket, probably not recording anything. Anyway, if you have a set of data, you know, maybe I have the flower petals, the flower color, whatever. I have these variables. You can input them into the computer. You can run programs like ANOVA, Analysis of Variance of Data. You can get all of these correlation coefficients, these well, I'm jumping ahead. I haven't told you what a correlation coefficient is. But you can get the covariance. You can get these correlation and autocorrelation functions, very important. Okay. And this relates the covariance to the correlation functions, and if they are statistically independent, then this becomes zero, and the covariance is zero. And this is a good, simple starting point. If the covariance is zero, the functions have, the variables have no relationship to each other. We'll usually say that they're statistically independent. Okay? Now, here is the correlation coefficient. This is going to come up in chapters 10, 11, and 12. I assume most of you have heard of correlation coefficient before in all your stat classes. What we're going to do in chapter 10 is it's going to tell us what's the relationship between two things. It might be, how much does this look like an A? And we'll use the things like correlation coefficients. But the correlation coefficient is actually a normalized covariance. We normalize the covariance by the square root of the variances, the individual variances. So that's all it is. It's normalized, and because of that, it goes between minus 1 and plus 1. And since we're going to be coming back and using this a lot, if we have a correlation coefficient of 0, it means there's no relationship between the two. But plus 1 and minus 1 tells us an awful lot. If something is a plus 1, it usually means that the two variables are really highly related to each other. For example, if one's increasing, the other one might be increasing. The minus 1 means that they're, in essence, anti-correlated. If one's increasing, the other one might be decreasing or something. We'd have to look at the data and interpret whatever the physical quantity is. But near zero, uncorrelated, independent. If you're near one, very related, and it doesn't matter if it's plus or minus one. Okay. We typically use Gaussian probability density functions. Notice, and it doesn't show up super well, all of these now are bold. They're vectors or matrices. So that's a vector X, vector M. The vector M is nothing more than the means of each of the, that is the expected values of each of the variables. So this would simply be a vertical vector, expected value of x sub 1. Second element would be the expected value of x sub 2, etc. Transpose. Okay, transpose simply means taking that vertical vector, okay, making it horizontal. That's all. This is to make our dot products come out, because you can't take an exponential of a big vector. You want to end up with a number there. And the inverse function. We take the inverse of a matrix. We didn't talk enough about the covariance matrix, but it turns out it's really well behaved. I'll talk about it in a moment. It is symmetric, it's square, it's real valued. And typically, by the way, all of your MATLAB, your LINPACK, all of your numerical function libraries have a matrix inversion routine in it. And it's very well behaved. Now, typically, if you were doing real pattern recognition, you might have a lot of variables with a very, very complicated, you know, if you have 15 variables in there, you know, try imagine how you would plot that function or visualize it. Not the easiest thing in the world. Let's look at it. Well, actually, I guess this is just showing you some of the vector nature of everything. The mean, the expected value of each of the elements in the vector. And now, what is the covariance matrix? I said earlier, I didn't tell you enough about it. The point is that it's the product of x minus m and x minus m transpose. If I had the order reversed, if it was transpose, it would be like this. And when I multiply the elements and sum them up, what would I get? A number. Okay? A single number. But because they're in the reverse order, what happens? When I multiply the two vectors together, I get a square matrix. How big will it be? It'll be n by n. And each one of the elements will be, for example, if it's the 1, 2 element, it would be x sub 1 minus m sub 1, x sub 2 minus m sub 2, the expected value of that product. So basically, each one of the elements ends up becoming a, well, I guess maybe you don't want to say a simple number, but nothing too complicated. So each one of the elements is a covariance, and that's why it's called the covariance matrix, for those vectors. Okay? It's real and it's symmetric. Real means all the elements in it are real. Okay? No complex numbers. They can be positive, negative, or zero. That's okay. Symmetric. Symmetric across the diagonal. Okay? The 1, 2 point is equal to the 2, 1 point in the matrix. So you only need to technically calculate the upper diagonal, you know, the lower diagonal. Okay? And the rest of this is garbage. That's not really relevant to what we're going to do. Okay? I didn't really mean to say that it's worthless or anything. It just is not relevant. Okay? Now, how about, what does this thing look like for just two variables? And you've probably seen this before. And probably didn't even recognize what it was. Okay. Oh, I don't want to talk about those yet. Okay, but here's some pictures. I mean, this is in general what it could look like. Okay, and basically, it's Gaussian in two different directions. Okay. Now, we were writing it in terms of x and y. But, in general, if you look at this from the top, and this is only for two variables, the axes don't have to align. That is, the axes of this Gaussian distribution don't have to align with the axes of your coordinate system. And in fact, this is a top view looking down. That's x1, that's x2, that if I would look at one of these contours of some constant value, maybe a half or whatever, you notice that it's elliptical. And it has its own axes. Typically, the longest axis might be called the principal axis, just like an ellipse. And then this would be the second axis. Now, what I skipped on the previous slide is, it turns out that there's a great, really trivial way to calculate these axes. Okay, maybe you won't share my opinion that it's trivial. Okay, all you do is you get your MATLAB program, your LINPACK or whatever, and what, remember that covariance matrix that we just had? You compute the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix. And I mean, you've probably heard of eigenvectors and were never quite sure what they were. You know, it was a big word to impress friends. Okay, the eigenvectors are the different perpendicular axes of this probability distribution. They have a big meaning in pattern recognition. I assumed you talked about this in 484. Who took 484? You didn't do you did principal component analysis, Cajon and Loeb expansion, feature extraction. Okay. Well, it turns out when you compute the eigenvectors of the covariance matrix, they have a lot of meaning. Each one of the eigenvectors is one of the features, and it forms a complete orthogonal set. But don't worry for the rest of you. We may come back, actually we will come back and explain that in a little more detail. The key thing is, all of these are numerical routines. We're not going to subject you to all of the details of knowing how the computation is done. What we want you to know is, what are the end results of the computation good for? Okay, so covariance matrix, very, very useful. And if nothing else, just think of it as giving you the principal axis of your probability density function. Okay, oh, and this just talks, I think, about eigenvectors. No problem. Okay. Now, this is where I get started on what at least may at first seem to be an unrelated topic. Okay. These are now all slides, by the way, I've typed for a while, and then some additional help from a person in England. Okay. We might have a system now. Maybe we have a detector, and I don't know. Maybe it watches the intensity of sunlight or something. And I collect data over a while, and I get a waveform. And maybe I come back and run the experiment again, and I get another waveform. And I come back and get another. Okay, each one of those is one of these output waveforms. They're a function of t, and we're using the zeta here just to indicate, okay, I've done it at different times. The whole collection of these is called an ensemble. You know, we might say it's just a complete set of experiments, but these are different random waveforms. I shouldn't really say random waveforms. They're different waveforms representing a random variable that was collected. Okay, and in principle, these are always shown in books like this. There might be one, and next time we do it, it's slightly different. And basically, these, this would be our zeta axis, and they'd all be on the same t, and all on the same whatever axis. Actually, I guess that would be, well, actually, our notation is capital X. Okay. And you'll hear the term ensemble. Okay. But the key thing is output waveform. Okay. Now, back when we did the Wiener filter, I sort of did this and went through it very quickly. This is actually a very common way of expressing the best thing we can do to estimate something. Mean squared error is the difference between what something actually is and our best estimate of it. And usually, our best estimate is coming from noisy measurements, and we clean them up, like we did in Chapter 5 with the degradation functions, and we wanted to estimate what this actually is, and that's our estimate. So we do these things, but notice that it is the expected value. It is the expected value of the square. That means that we don't worry about positive and negative, we're just making it close. That's really what it's doing. Okay? So that's what mean square error is. It's precisely this, and if we minimize this, this then becomes the best mean square estimate of this. And I'm going to give you an example, because what we're going to do is we're going to sneak up on doing Kalman filters by starting with estimation, looking at it, and seeing how we can make it into a filter, and then into a recursive filter. So it's not, bang, here's the result. Okay, and this is a simple example where we might just have two variables, x and y. And in this particular case, there was also something about throws of a dice or something. But I mean, one thing that you've probably done a lot is you fit a curve to a data. And the most common one is you fit a straight line to a bunch of x and y data that you've gotten. Okay? But you've usually never thought about it in a statistical manner. So we're going to do it just slightly differently. So here's the idea. We give you x. You collect the data somehow. Actually, we don't give it to you. You're the grad students. You go out and collect the data. Okay? So you collect the data and give it to us. Now, given that, what we'd like to do is say, well, here's our measured y's. We would like to... Oh, we're doing x given y. Okay, I got it backwards. Sorry. Given y, we want to estimate x. Okay, and so x hat equals ay plus b. That's the equation of a straight line. I don't know what a and b are, but I'm going to do it in the mean square error sense. So I'm going to compute the expected value. Everything is statistical now. The expected value of the squared error. This is x. This is our estimate of x. Okay? Now, all of this stuff sort of becomes plug and chug. And the last time we did a little bit of how this expectation value, which remember is the integral of the variable times the probability density function. Okay? So we put in here, what is our estimate? This is our estimate function, ay plus b. How do you optimize, well, how do you minimize anything? I don't want to say optimization. If you talk to Professor Chang Kong, there's many ways to do that. But we just want to do something simple here. We're going to set the derivative of this expression with respect to a and with respect to b, which are our two variables, to zero. That's all we're going to do. Okay, and we'll just take the derivative here with respect to A. It's a squared quantity. You can take this, since this is a linear operation, I can take it inside the integral, move stuff outside the integral. Remember, all of this is going on behind the scenes, so I can just come in here, take my derivative operator inside this, because I'm going to be integrating with respect to what? X and Y. But I'm taking the derivative with respect to A. I can interchange the order of operations very easily. So I can come in here to X minus AY minus B. Got to Okay, remember, that's multiplied by that. And then take the derivative. Oh, this is with respect to B first. Okay. And then since that's a minus B, when I take the derivative, I get a minus 1. Okay. So I moved the derivative operator inside, did all the derivatives, apply the expectation value to all of them, and I'll move the constants outside. You see, I'm moving a lot of stuff through that integral, in and out. Minus 2, expectation value of x, plus 2, and by the way, don't forget that minus 1 there. That's why your signs are changing. 2aey plus 2b. Okay, that's equal to 0, and I can solve for b, and it is the expected value of x. That's just the mean. That can be easily computed. Minus a times the expected value of y. The expected value of y can be easily computed from the data. And by the way, this brings back what I said earlier. If you're given a bunch of data and you don't know anything about individual probabilities, assume that they're equally probable. So that in this case, if we had 6 pieces of data, assume that each outcome is 1/6. That would be a good starting point. Now, we still have to find A. And to find A, we're going to take the derivative with respect to A. And we substitute our result for B into the expression. That's minus mx plus amy. Okay? And I put all the terms with a's together, all the terms without a's together, and we do, basically, I'm just rearranging things. Okay? Notice, this looks an awful lot like our stuff for the covariates, doesn't it? You've got an x minus a mean, and I've got a product of variables minus their means. Over here, another. I know that the kind of expression you always get is a variance, a correlation, okay? So I always want to set things up in that form. So look at what happens, okay? Using those definitions, it's sigma x, you know, that's just the variance in x squared. This is the variance in y squared. And that's our covariance. So you've got a simple expression now with statistical quantities in it. Variances, covariances, all means, all of that can be computed for a given set of data. No problem. Take the derivative with respect to A. It's pretty easy. Okay. Set it equal to 0. Solve for A. It'll be the covariance divided by the square of the variance. Okay. Yes. Did I screw something up? Remember, I typed these up.
The second line there, we have a 2A mu 1 1 as a result. So that means we multiplied our x minus mx times y minus my out to get 2 of them?
Yes. Yes. Because when I do my cross product there, it's going to be that times that, and I'll get those cross product terms.
And then, so we're also left off.
Actually, there's a 2 missing then, isn't there?
But since we're taking the derivative for A and B, it
doesn't matter. Yeah, but still, I want these notes to be really accurate for the next time I use this. So I'm glad someone's paying attention, because I spent a couple hours last night trying to find typos in here. I'd be glad. You should have seen the first version of this. Okay. Yeah, there's a 2 missing. That's a very good observation. Excellent. Won't impact your grade, though. But you might get, if you run fast, you might be first in line for pizza. Okay. Anyway, this gives us A in terms of statistical properties of the data. And as I said before, you can run programs like ANOVA. There's all kinds of programs that will compute statistics and sets of data for you. okay, and you can get the covariance, okay, you can get the variance. You can get these numbers, plug them in, divide it, you get a value for that. You plug in the mean values plus that expression. Notice all the variances are associated with 1. That's because we substituted into it and got effectively a higher order equation because of it. And then all the means are in the other one. And this would give us a statistical least squared error estimator of this data. And that's really what an awful lot of this is all about. Now, we move on to some more definitions. Yeah, I forgot who asked earlier about functions and stuff. Okay, we think of functions as vectors. I know that's probably, I remember back when I was first exposed to this concept, that was actually pretty difficult to swallow. Because, you know, vectors I could always understand as arrows in a multidimensional space. Very simple thing. You know, functions don't look like vectors at all. But it turns out they have some interesting properties which makes them behave like vectors. For example, we can define an inner product between two functions. Okay? And it's simply the product of the two functions integrated over whatever is the domain of the functions. And in this case, I put them over time, minus infinity to plus infinity. We can talk about the length. Actually, most of the time, we might be thinking more of the energy of the function. But if you stop and think about it, the length, if you were just with a vector, wouldn't the length be related to, you would think, the strength of the vector. So, this is a reasonable thing. But we take the square root, so it has whatever the physical units were, if there were any, associated with V. You know, if it were a function of length or position or something, the norm or length would be in the same. Okay? The distance metric, this one, actually, you can take a pretty simple interpretation of, okay, I've got two functions, I simply take the difference between them at every point, we square it. Usually you want to square everything because what we want to get what the distance is in an absolute sense, in the length, in terms of sort of the sense of the length of the vector between the two, and we don't want a sign associated with it. So we take the difference, we square it, we integrate it, and take the square root. A little bit like root mean square. Now, that you may have seen before. Well, I guess there's nothing here. I guess my discrete versions of that disappeared. Okay, but these were continuous functions. All that would happen with discrete versions is that you'd have sums instead of integrals. That would be the only change. Now, random variables, which is what we've been talking about, this is actually really very interesting and similar. We talk about the inner product between two random variables. We treat it just like a pair of vectors. We call it the inner product. Except in this case, what it is it will be the integral of xy probability xy dx dy. So we've got then, it will be the expected value of xy. And this is really interesting because if the expected value of xy is 0, remember, this is the case where they're independent, uncorrelated, they're orthogonal to each other. So from that information sense, we can think of these as orthogonal functions. But we're going to use a vector approach now to functions to set up the Kalman filter. We can have the norm or length of a random variable, and it's exactly like we did with the continuous variable. The only thing is that we get these expected values in everything. So it's the square root of the expected value of x squared. We can have the same distance metric, but notice there's an expected value inside there. Because remember, these are random variables. So the thing that makes the most sense is, what is the mean? What is the average of all of these different waveforms that we could collect? You know, if I would go in and do this experiment real world, this would tell me what I would expect to see. It may differ because of noise. Okay? Now, here's where we're going to start sneaking up on the Kalman stuff. This is the general idea of a linear estimator. Okay? The idea of a linear estimator is that I might have n samples of something. Now, this might be the position of a vehicle. You know, I might be looking out there and there's this wild robot from Carnegie Mellon wandering around over there, you know, staggering around or whatever. Okay, and we might want to know what the position of it will be. And that's what the whole idea is. This might be the position at time n minus 1, previous time, two previous time intervals, and we back up. So we can have any number of these. In practice, t can't get too big. Or you, first of all, you've got to store all of that data, and the second thing is you just have long calculations. Okay? Now, the idea is that d hat is an estimate of the signal, whatever our signal is. Okay? Now, here's how we take a measurement. X's are our measurements. They're the real, uncorrupted signal that we want to find. This would be the position, for example. And this is white noise. So and this makes perfect sense. You go out there and you measure something, you always have error. You always have noise. Those are at least the noise is incorporated in here. I'll show you how to include measurement error in a moment. Okay, so that's what's going on. So X is our experimentally measured thing, and it's a noise-free thing plus the noise. You notice I use very scientific terms there. Thing. Okay, because we're doing this in general. And these can be positions, velocities, all kinds of stuff. Okay? And the coefficients, h, are just that. They're numbers. These aren't any fancy functions. So it's just some number times the current measurement, some number times the previous measurement. That's all it is. For those signal processing types, it looks exactly like a digital filter. That's all it is. And that's why, in fact, this is going to be called the Kalman filter. It looks like one. There are three types of things that you can do with this. And you may want to do different things depending upon what your research is in. One, if I've got that out-of-control Carnegie Mellon vehicle out there, I might want to know where it's going to be. That's extrapolation. I might want to say, what is going to be the value at some, maybe, k intervals in the future? Or, I might want to go back and look at previous data and maybe interpolate or find a value that I didn't have. Okay? So I can go backwards. Or, I can just smooth data. So there's three things. I'm going to be the most interested in extrapolation. But you can actually do these two as well. And this will come up over and over. Okay? Now, this is one of the big things that Kalman did. Okay, he did a couple things. This is the first one, the orthogonality principle. Let me back up and point out that this estimate is nothing. Remember, let's think of these now as our random variables. Measurement at one point, measurement at another. Technically, each of those is a random variable. Own probability density function, all of that, okay? And we could put those in a vector, and we multiply each one of the elements of the vector by a constant. Okay, but the point is, that's a vector in its own right. So, let's look at this picture and see if it makes sense. X would be the original data. D hat, which is that thing, is, you notice, it's a constant times each one of the elements of the X vector. So, these are vectors here, so some AX, okay, this is our estimate of D. And it turns out where we previously used the idea of mean squared error, well, it turns out from the vector approach, the mean squared error is minimized, okay, when the difference between our estimate and the actual D is perpendicular to the original data. That sort of makes sense if you stop and think about it. It's an orthogonality thing. I want the minimum distance. And what it's really saying is, I'll get the minimum distance when this vector is perpendicular. And that was something that Kalman was very innovative with. Now, you may have to think about this a couple times before you really believe it. But that's fundamental, because we're going to do things by making the error orthogonal to the data. The orthogonality principle. Now we're going to do two simple examples and then jump up to the Kalman filter. And the notation here can get a little messy, so I'll do my best to try and keep you from getting confused. Okay, we're going to have the same thing that we had previously. We make a measurement. It's composed of the signal plus the noise. Now we're going to use D. D is what we want to estimate, and in this case, it's simply the signal. It's not a function of the signal, but simply the signal. And in fact, by telling you that, I can tell you that things can get a lot more complicated. You know, you might want to estimate a function of something instead. Okay, and we're going to do these just following these our previous definitions. We're going to require the error, which is going to be the difference between the noise-free signal and then our estimate of the signal to be orthogonal to the data. So this error, which is the difference between D and D hat. I'll tell you what D hat is in a moment, but D is just the signal. D hat is the estimate of the signal. We want that to be orthogonal to the experimentally measured data. Okay? And since these are random variables, we do it as the expected value. So now we just plug and chug and see what happens. The difference between the signal and the estimate of the signal, the experimental measurements, expectation value should be zero. This is a single observation estimator. It doesn't look at anything in the past. There's no history. It looks only at the current value. So it simply will be some coefficient times the current value of x. We plug that in. That's our estimate. And just like we were doing with the curve fitting and taking the derivatives and stuff, I'm just going to multiply it out and see what's left. Okay, the expected value of D times X, and I'd have these are constants, so minus H naught, and then the expected value of XX. And guess what? These now all of a sudden start to look like all these statistical things that we've been talking about all lecture. Okay, this is a little confusing because this is really S, what we want to estimate. But notice, what's the expected value of the product of two variables? Okay, it's going to be our correlation function. Okay, in this case, it would be really R dx, but it's really, since D is S, it's RSX. So that's RSX of 0. Now, I haven't talked too much about what does the argument mean. Okay, the common notation here is that that is the difference between the right value and the left value. That's technically this n minus that n. And what's the difference? 0. What it really means is that I have the time axes of the two functions aligned when I'm taking the product and doing the integral. You can have shifts. We'll see that when we have two variables. But if only one, we put in 0. And the general rule is it doesn't matter if you would do left minus right or right minus left, just so you do it in every one of your equations. Okay? So that's our correlation function, and it's a cross-correlation function. It's the signal and the measurements. Okay? And the second one is an autocorrelation function of the measurements. Okay? With that H-naught, and we just, in our optimum sense, we just solve for H-naught. So if I give you sets of data, or you go out and take the measurements, okay, in principle, you can calculate those correlation functions. I'm going to show you a simple example, by the way. That's for a single estimator. Now, you have to watch out for faculty. You know, one estimate is not good enough. That's what your advisor would tell you. Crummy. You need two. Actually, we want maybe three or four or five. But in principle, we want to just see how it scales up. Same problem, but I'm going to allow you to estimate now using the current value and the previous measured value. That's the only difference. And what that means is that everything's the same down to here. I want to make my estimate now something times the current value plus something times the previous value. I'm going to do exactly the same thing. I plug this into there, and I get two equations, and what I want to do now is write this all as correlation functions and variances and stuff. Note, the big difference is I have a previous value. That's an n minus 1. These n minus 1s show up in here. And you can sort of see, oh, I'm going to have an expected value minus h1, but it's an expected value of xn minus 1 xn. You know, if I didn't have the n minus 1, it'd be the same axis, or rather the origins would be aligned. So think of these two functions. I've now shifted one, delayed in time by one. So it's not quite, it is the autocorrelation function, but there's a time shift in there. And I can subtract one from the other, okay. And, well, let's just see what all of this looks like. But notice, there are two equations. And I substitute, basically, I reduce these. Technically, that is a D. It's going to become an S. There's an RXX is 0. Notice now, RXX minus 1. Okay. So we've got some minus 1s and 1s just because the way we did our shifting. And you notice I'm keeping consistent right minus left. And if you have two equations, where are your two unknowns, H0 and H1? Guess what? I'm going to have a matrix equation. Notice, all the elements of this side are correlation functions. All the values on the other side are correlation functions. So if I can compute the statistics of the data, I can tell you how to estimate it. And what you might do is collect data for a while and say, okay, the statistics will not change. It'll be stationary. Okay? Sorry, I'm not teaching the random variables course, but it would be fun. But if the statistics remain the same, I can go compute it from some experimental data and then come back and do a best estimator on different experimental data. Okay, and this I'm not going to go into a whole lot. I can see that I'm going to be running short and I don't want to stand between you and your pizza. Okay. But here's a simple problem, a typical homework problem. This would take actually a good one for the PhD qualifier, but we don't have a section on probability and statistics. So, but here's the signal, or the measurement. It's a signal, noise-free, plus white noise. And in this case, we give you an autocorrelation function. And it may be that we know this because we did a mathematical model of the system. It could be that when we went out and measured data, but there's something that we did to come up with this correlation function. That's a separate problem unto itself. And we have to compute the autocorrelation and cross-correlation function. We have we have X and we have RSS, and basically it becomes plug and grind. RXX is zero. The definition is X times X, expected value. You put in signal plus noise in both of them. You can multiply everything out inside the expectation value. You get four terms. Now, the first one is RSS, because it's the expected value of the signal times the signal, and they gave us that. So we don't worry about that. But you should know what happens to the other terms, the signal and the noise. What is one of the first things that you should learn as any engineer? You sure hope that your noise is uncorrelated with your system. Okay? Usually, noise is totally independent. And that's what you recognize right here. The signal and the noise are independent. Their correlation function is zero. And it doesn't matter if it's signal times noise or noise times signal. It's the same thing because the probability density function should be the same. Okay? So those go to zero. And now, the next thing is, what's the behavior of white noise? What is the autocorrelation function of white noise? Imagine you have this really horrible bunch of white noise. And you've got, well, the definition of the autocorrelation function would be, I just duplicate the waveform. That's perfectly correlated with itself. But if I do any shift at all, I have no idea why it's beeping and flashing. I hope I didn't run out of memory. Okay, but the autocorrelation function for white noise is a delta function. It's one when they exactly overlap. If you shift it at all, there's no correlation. And then you can plug in the values and actually get numerical values. Okay. So, the rest of this is now just going through and computing things. I'm going to super speed up so we can get at least through this topic. The only thing that's new, if we do a two observation, is